While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the Eye. The Eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis, where the headlines meet perspective. As your trusted source for the latest news, developments, and insights from Namibia, in around the world, we go beyond the headlines to examine the issues shaping our societies, our economies, and the future. From governance and the public policy to business, technology, health, climate change, and international affairs, we provide the context and analysis needed to understand the stories that matter. Now this afternoon, we focus on the conversations and developments driving public discourse, including efforts to strengthen governance and accountability in the public sector, economic and business development, regional affairs, and the global trends influencing decision-making at home and abroad. Now, right here on the Reader News Analysis, we believe informed citizens make stronger communities. That is why we are committed to delivering credible journalism, balanced reporting, and thoughtful analysis that helps you understand not only what is happening, but why it matters. Now, through comprehensive coverage, expert insights, exclusive interviews, and real-time updates, we connect the dots behind today's major developments and emerging issues. Whether it is a policy shift, a financial development, an innovation-shaping industry, innovation shaping industries, or a global event with local implications. Our goal remains the same, that is to keep you informed, engaged, and ahead of the conversation. So stay connected with us across our broadcasting and digital platforms for the latest updates throughout the day. Now join in on the conversation by sharing your views and be part of a growing community that values informed dialogue and credible news. Because this is On the Reader News Analysis, delivering the facts, examining the impact, and helping you make sense of the stories shaping Namibia and the world. Let's get right into today's discussions. The Bank of Namibia hosts internal audit awareness day to advance public sector governance. Bank of Namibia today is hosting an internal audit awareness day under the theme "The Role of Internal Audit in Enhancing Public Sector Governance," bringing together experts and stakeholders to explore the growing importance of internal audit in strengthening governance and improving public sector performance. Now, a key feature of the event is a panel discussion titled "Positioning Internal Audit for Impact, Governance Reforms, Oversight, and Capacity Building in the Public Sector." The discussion examines how internal audit can be positioned as a strategic partner in driving governance reform, enhancing oversight, and building institutional capacity across the public sector. The panel brings together public finance, governance, institutional transformation, financial reporting experts, including Oscar Capelao, Lillian Mwangi, Karen Elaho, and many others. Now together, the panelists unpack on how internal audit supports sound governance, promotes operational efficiency, strengthens risk management practices, and contributes to improved public sector performance. They also share insights on enhancing accountability, strengthening oversight structures, and positioning internal audit functions to deliver greater value and impact within public institutions. They even highlight the critical role internal audits play in fostering transparency, accountability, and effective governance within the public sector. Let's take a listen.
You are saying your books are fine, right?
Adapting with integrity, I close the quote. As internal auditors, that's a disadvantage of paper, must pause here and there. of auditors and professionals and leaders, we must continue to embrace change, uphold integrity, and contribute meaningfully to building resilient institutions that serve not our interest, but public interest. On that note, I thank you.
We will reflect. We're going to share some insight of what we are picking up when we are doing our work as auditors and how we can collaborate with internal audit so that we can improve. Okay. Normally, when audit is done, we express four audit opinions. And normally, those audit opinions, they are misconstrued to say they might be indicating fraudulent activities, among other things. But what we are just highlighting as auditors is governance and accountability. Your audit opinion will reflect to what the governance is being done in that institution. I would like to put it in perspective in a picture. Okay. So in a picture, what happens when we give you unqualified audit opinion, we are saying your books are fine, right? That's why you see that glass in the water, it's bubbling. Your books are fine. When we give you qualified, the glass now is half. We are saying there's something which is not right. Half of your things are good. But somewhere, somehow, there are some things which are not right, which need to be fixed. When we give you advice, we are in disagreement with what you've presented to us. That's why that water is blue. If I ask you, you say it's brown. If I ask you, we will end up the whole day discussing this water and you will not come up with the correct picture of that water. Right? We are disagreeing with what you've presented. When we give you a disclaimer, everything is gone. There is no controls. The governance structures are not working. Basically, everything gone. And when we are at the office, we always say, when we are at a disclaimer level, you need a prayer, whereby on this prayer, we need God himself, Jesus, and all the angels. They must come and assist us to come out of the disclaimer. But disclaimer is... You can always come away from disclaimer. It's not a permanent solution. It's just the willing of the people who are charged with governance.
Is viewed. Listen.
Okay. So in a picture, what happens? When we give you unqualified audit opinion, we are saying your books are fine. Right? That's why you see that glass in the water, it's bubbling. Your books are fine. When we give...
Great news! Imper just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imper? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
The glass now is half. We are saying there's something which is not right. Half of your things are good. But somewhere, somehow, there are some things which are not right, which need to be fixed. When we give you advice, we are in disagreement with what you've presented to us. That's why that water is blue. If I ask you, you say it's brown. If I ask you, we will end up the whole day discussing this water and you will not come up with the correct picture of that water. Right? We are disagreeing with what you've presented. When we give you a disclaimer, everything is gone. There is no controls. The governance structures are not working. Basically, everything gone. And when we are at the office, we always say, when we are at a disclaimer level, you need a prayer, whereby on this prayer, we need God himself, Jesus, and all the angels. They must come and assist us to come out of the disclaimer. But disclaimer is, you can always come away from disclaimer. It's not a permanent solution. It's just the willing of the people who are charged with governance, the willing of the internal auditors, and the willing of the management. You can come out from that specific area. Now, I need you to take particular attention to the half class and the adverse class and the disclaimer class, because we are going to talk more about it in the next slides. Okay? If we move on to the OMAS, OMAS is the ministries, offices, agents, shortcut OMAS. You see that they've been doing very well for the past 5 years. And in 2025, they flipped. They dropped 46% from unqualified to qualified. So as internal auditors, we also need to go and look what has happened in OMAS. Why did they flip? What is the cause? What is the root cause? We need to identify it, fix it now before we go to the broken glass. Now, these are the audit opinions. If we move from these audit opinions and put this into value context, how much of the actual expenditure was qualified in terms of OMAS? So 74 billion was qualified. Auditors could not give a clean audit opinion on the OMAS in 2025. 75 billion, and our budget was 86 billion. So 75 billion is qualified. Only 11 billion is given a clean audit. We also need to ask, but why? So what we have done here is an office, we have selected the ministries which have been qualified. We add the total of their actual expenditure. This is actual expenditure, it's not budget. So we need to go back as external auditors. Let's reassist those charged with governance and find out why are they in this state. They were doing good. All of a sudden, they flip. All right? We move on to, I always call them small brothers, village councils. The picture changes from OMAS. So in village councils, you pick up the red. They are not submitting financial statements. There is none submission of financial statements. Eventually, when they submit, mostly they are getting adverse and disclaimers. As you see, for the past 5 years, only two, at one point, were given an unqualified audit opinion, the green one. That's the village councils. If we move on to the municipalities, still the same picture as village councils. There is, for the past five years, only one had managed to get an unqualified audit opinion in 2024. And thereafter, none has managed to get that audit opinion. And the majority of them, the graph of not submitting is increasing. Non-submission of financial statements or delayed submission of financial statements. This graph of village councils and municipalities is the same if you analyze your town councils, same picture. If you analyze your regional councils, same picture. So if you combine both of them, here is a combination of all of them, the regional councils, the municipalities, the town councils, and the village councils. We have combined them, all of them now. So you find for the past 5 years, we can count the unqualified audit reports here and there. And you also see that the graph of non-submission is also going up. Financials are not submitted for audit. They receive money from Ministry of Finance. They receive money from residents. But the financial statements are not submitted for audit. We are missing the opportunity of accountability there if we don't submit financial for audits. Then SOEs. On SOEs, I will explain on the other coming slide on SOEs. There's a technicality there on SOEs. And SOEs, some they are doing good, some they are doing bad. It's a bit different from the local authorities. If you check, you can still get unqualified opinions and so on. But on SOEs, the catch is, on SOE, the catch is this one. We have got about 96 SOE state-owned enterprises in Namibia, plus or minus 96, right? Each of these 96 is what we call an establishing act, right? So the establishing act will identify who the auditor is. And it also identify what's supposed to be done in terms of that entity's governance. So we have a group A of SOEs, those SOEs which have been allocated to the Office of Auditor General, who are audited by Auditor General. Okay? Then we have got another group which appoint its own auditors. Those financials, they don't pass through the Office of Auditor General. Then we have got another group C, whereby they appoint their own auditor, in consultation or with consent of Auditor General. Then we've got Group D, whereby the audit is performed by the external auditors, and they bring those audit files to the Office of Auditor General for quality assurance. Right. But having said that, all these audits, all of them, this Group A, Group B, Group C, and Group D, all of them, they end up at Public Accounts Committee at Parliament. All of them. So, Kale, at this present time, we also need to follow up as internal auditors. When the audit of Bank of Namibia is completed, when the audit of NAMPOWER is completed, when the audit of NAMWATER is completed, these audits, when the minister has tabled this audit in Parliament, is it filtering through to the audit committee? Majority of the times, they don't filter through to the audit committee. They are just tabled in Parliament. But for that scrutiny, the last scrutiny is not done because that report did not go to Parliament and Accounts Committee. So we also need to follow it up as internal auditors. That accountability must be fulfilled. Okay? Now, what are the issues which we are picking up as external auditors when we are performing these audits? The major issue which we pick up is unstructured governance, ineffective boards, councils, commissions. You go to a client, the structure is there. Who report to who is not there, it's not documented. There is no law saying we must move from here to there, we must move from here to there. It's just things which are hanging out there. Some of the organizations have got internal audit, but it's not effective. I will still come back to that in following slides. Some of the organizations, they don't even have internal audit. Like local authorities, we've got 71 local authorities. We only have, we've got 59 local authorities, excluding regional councils. We only have one out of 59, which is having internal audit. And I'm not saying this internal audit is effective. I'm just saying we've got one, right? You must not get me wrong. I'm not saying it's effective. I'm saying we have got one internal audit out of 59 local authorities. Of course, regional councils, thanks to the Minister of Finance, regional councils, all of them now, they have internal audit in place. Right? Some of the challenges which we also pick up when we are doing audits, I'm not going to run through them. I'm just going to pick up the most cut-crossing ones. Missing documents. When you go for, like, remember on my first slides, I said financial statements are not submitted. Organizations are taking, like, 5 years without submitting financial statements. Eventually, when they submit, when you go to audit, the documentation is no longer there. Or it's just dumped in the storerooms, whatever, wherever it is, but it's not available for audit purpose. It's one of the most and most prevalent issue in our entities. Fruitless expenditure. This one is also very prevalent in the across, whereby you have a CFO, you have a finance manager, you have accountants, but we still outsource our books to be done by someone else. It's a very prevalent in all majority of our SOEs and majority of the local authorities. We have issues whereby VAT reconciliations are not done, and you are penalized by Ministry of Finance or NAMRA of not submitting VAT on time or tax returns on time. And the person who is responsible for that accumulation of those penalties is not taken to task. You have someone in the office who is supposed to make sure that the VAT reconciliations are done or pay is done. He doesn't do that or she doesn't do that. Minister of NAMRA penalize you, and we are just quiet. And we also don't highlight it in our report to say there is something wrong here. Right? Then I move on to what needs to happen. So what is it, what we need to do? We need to improve on our board competence. I was reading the Act for Bank of Namibia. It's a very good act in terms of the way they've defined their audit committee. I also encourage you guys to go and read that act. The way they've defined their audit committee, there is no green, blue, black, gray areas. When they say on our audit committee we need A, B, C, D, it's easier to comply to that law than leaving it blank. For example, if we say we need someone's financial expertise on audit committee, what is the definition of financial expertise on audit committee? Can I come with a normal accounting degree? Can I come with experience as an accountant? Can I come as a chartered accountant? What definition is expertise needed? So if you check the Act for Bank of Namibia, it's kind of standing out for me. We also need to ensure the internal audit is properly resourced if we are going to go far with internal audit. Resourcing of internal audit is a thorny issue among the SOEs. In Central, in OMAS, it's even a bigger problem. Financial reporting, majority of the SOEs, they've come on board. They've got now financial reporting framework. Some, they still not yet adopted any financial reporting framework. Again, there is no law which is compelling us to say we must use IPSAS or we must use IFRIS or we must use whatever framework is supposed to be used. It's left for the board, or it's left for the management and the board to come up with one. Now, if you have in the board whereby there's someone who is not, the expertise of finance is not strong, you end up not having a proper financial reporting framework. Okay, shall we move on? Who needs to come on board for us to improve? Parliament and Accounts Committee must definitely come on board. We need them to scrutinize all the audit reports, whether it's unqualified, qualified, all of them, and really also play an oversight role there. Sometimes you have an unqualified audit report, but if you go through it, we have written off major, we've written off some assets, we've done impairments, huge impairments. For us as accountants, as accounting professionals, it's fine. It's what the standard says, we can do impairment. But someone must ask, but why are you impairing 50 million? What is the issue of you impairing an asset which is worth 50 million? So this is the role where a public accounts committee must really come on board. We also need accounting officers to come on board. The internal audit has moved very greatly from what it was before. Now we are value addition to the organization. So they need to understand that what we are doing is the value addition. We are not policing them. We also need, when people are on the board, we also need them to be courageous. Because if I'm a board member or I'm a committee member of an audit committee and I'm sitting there and the financial statements are not submitted for 5 years and I'm still sitting there, I'm reappointed and I'm still going through with the train, questions must be asked. But why? This board member is a committee member, audit committee, and is not enforcing the CEO to produce financials. The Prime Minister also needs to come on board. We need to have SOE statistics from the Prime Minister. We need to have the performance of the SOEs from the Prime Minister. Since now, on the new proposal, they will be under his oversight. The Office of the Auditor General also need to provide constructive recommendations which can be implemented. And the audit bill is also, the Parliament need to come on board and finalize the audit bill. The audit bill has been coming for more than 15 years. Yep, the audit bill has been coming for over 15 years. It's not moving so that it can be enacted and come a law. Also, Minister of Finance need to come on board big time. We need the capacitation of the auditors. Minister of Finance, we need them to play a role. We need capacitation of the accountants in the ministries. We need them to train CAs outside training practice. It's allowed, it's there. There is training of chartered accountants in the practice whereby you train, you do your articles from the big fours and so on. There is also training of chartered accountants without taking them to the big fours. So we need Minister of Finance to come on board. We also need Minister of Finance to also push their public finance management bill. It's also like Auditor General's bill, which is also have taken time to be finalized. We also need Minister of Finance to come. The last bulletin is also very important. We also need Minister of Finance to come with someone who can oversee our standards. Currently, if I am an auditor, and currently also fellow colleagues as internal auditors, if we have a disagreement of interpretation of IPSAS or IFRIS, we go to where as auditors? PAB is a regulator for auditors. It does not interpret, does not prescribe what I'm talking about. ICAN also is a regulator for its members. ACCA is a regulator for its members. CIMA, same. CIA, same. IPI, same. So currently we don't have someone whereby if we disagree or if you disagree with your auditors on an interpretation of the standard, where do you go to? You leave this room open to the auditor to write in the report what he, because I'm the last one to write in the report. So I'll put what I feel is correct. There is no independent board which says, okay, there is a disagreement, we can interpret. There are also very small organizations like village councils, like small funds in the ministries, like small SOEs. Can we subject them to full IFRIS? Can we subject them to full IPSAS? It's not economical to subject a small fund to a full IFRIS or IPSAS. It might be expensive. So we need a board which can say these small SOEs, they can use this Namibian customized standard. All right, I'm almost there. So as an internal audit, external auditors and internal audit, what should we do together? The advantage of internal audit, you have got you do risk assessment in real time. When COVID is happening, you are there, you are doing risk assessment in real time. The disadvantage of external auditors, we come once in a year. So we want you and us to be a team whereby if we pick up something, we communicate with you. If you pick up something, we communicate with you, you check it in real time. Continuous monitoring of control. Also, internal audit, you are monitoring control on a daily basis, as we only does that once in a year when we do our financial reporting. We also need internal audit to give assurance on the financial system, on the financial reporting system of that organization. The books which we are getting or the books which are being produced, are they, is there integrity in them? You find, for example, we have issues whereby we still, some of our public interest enterprises, they are still using 1969 software to do the accounting, MS-DOS. Currently, if you are using MS-DOS, you will not You know? So as internal audit, we also need to advise the board and the committees to say, no, this system now is well out. We cannot continue using it. Let's we upgrade or let's we find ideas to bring new systems.
Okay. Quite interesting and informative right there for, I think, any business and public institutions themselves. They will do well to listen to this. Now, some of the things that he, the negatives that he mentioned, okay, that's part of his slides that he said he's not going to go through them per detail as follows. He says, weak internal controls. In some cases, controls do not exist when we're talking about audit, missing supporting documents, audit evidence, most prevalent, those supporting documents that then are usually prevalent when it comes to if where evidence is needed, delayed responses to audit processes that includes documents for planning purposes and management letters, political interference and inadequate enforcement, and for these boundaries, encroachment and oversight need to be put in place. Political interference and inadequate enforcement. You know, for some parastatals, it will be they are partially private, partially public. And even for complete public institutions, the moment there's political interference, then it would mean that things will not be properly audited, or there might not be even any audit at all, or there might be interference. Unresolved findings and material misstatements, unavailability of management during engagement and exit meetings. Audit reports are produced, findings are documented, and recommendations are made, yet the same issues reoccur year after year because there are insufficient consequences for non-compliance. Example, REDs, reconciliations, VAT payables and receivables. And lastly, fruitless expenditure not addressed. Now, as government and public institutions face increasing pressures to demonstrate accountability and deliver value for money, internal audits are gaining recognition as a critical tool for safeguarding public resources. And honestly, internal audit is something that should exist for any company. I was an accountant myself, where I was dealing with finances for a particular organization, and it was under my tenure or my leadership that I told them, when, you know, as I was reading down certain books that were to guide that organization, we audit was supposed to be some of the things that are done. And even BIPA itself, you know, it makes provision for when the company was audited and stuff like that. And I had to make it known to them that you are supposed to have an audit. There's supposed to be an external qualified person coming to oversee the books and see where the finances is going, how it is being spent. Otherwise, those who are managing the finances, the accountants, can easily steal the money and take the money, and there will be no accountability, and nobody will find out. They'll probably go find out years later. That is if somebody comes in also who's just very sharp and analyzing. But then, you know, when you're starting work newly, you want to build on how you can do better. It's very unlikely that most of the time you want to trace back to work from the past, unless you're an auditor. But if you're just someone, normal employee who's doing your work, you're most likely not to go back to the past. Hence why audits are very important. And it shouldn't be only now that Bonnie's speaking about it, but every public institution should be accountable, should be audited, their finances, every school, every, oh my goodness, we can't emphasize this enough. Now, while they are not a cure for corruption or a cure all for corruption or financial mismanagement, experts do argue that effective internal audit functions can significantly reduce waste, strengthen oversight, and improve decision making across the public sector. Now, an internal audit is an independent and objective assessment that is conducted within an organization to evaluate the effectiveness of governance, risk management, and internal control processes. Now, unlike external audits, which primarily focus on verifying financial statements and compliance, internal audits take a broader approach by examining how systems, processes, and controls operate and identifying areas where improvements are needed. Now, within the public sector, internal audits play a crucial role in ensuring that public funds are used for their intended purposes. They assess whether policies and procedures are being followed, identify weaknesses in financial controls, evaluate risks that could affect service delivery, and recommend measures to improve efficiency and accountability. The financial experts note that many cases of mismanagement stem not only from deliberate wrongdoing, but also from weak oversight. Because when you are a manager and you're not the one that's dealing with the finances, and you're not getting somebody to oversee what your accountant or your HR officer or whoever is dealing with the finances, because I know for some HR officers, they are the ones responsible for payments as well, you know, for especially for companies where they don't have a one person for each function, and also inadequate controls. So financial experts note that many cases of mismanagement stem not only from deliberate wrongdoing, but also from weak oversight, from inadequate controls, from poor procurement practices, and ineffective risk management. Internal audits help detect those weaknesses before they escalate into significant financial losses or governance failures. And I still remember Director General of the Anti-Corruption Commission, Mr. Paulus Noah, speaking about corruption. You know, here we're talking about accountability, but, you know, I think the two go hand in hand about corruption that can be rather intercepted, where you strengthen the system in such a way that it's impossible, makes it very difficult for corruption to take place. Now, one of the key benefits of internal auditing is its preventative function. Rather than waiting for problems to emerge, auditors continuously review operations and provide management with timely information that supports corrective action. Now, this proactive approach helps institutions identify risks early, strengthen controls, and promote a culture of accountability. Internal audits also contribute to better decision making by providing management and governing bodies with independent assessments of organizational performance. Auditors enable leaders to make informed decisions based on evidence rather than on assumptions. This can lead to more efficient use of resources, improved service delivery, and greater public trust. However, the effectiveness of internal audits depends on several factors. Now, experts emphasize that audit units must be independent, must be adequately resourced, and staffed with skilled professionals. Equally important is the willingness of management and oversight bodies to implement audit recommendations. Now, without leadership commitment and accountability mechanisms, audit findings may have little practical impact. Good governance specialists further argue that internal audits should be viewed not as fault-finding exercises, but as a strategic tool that help institutions achieve their objectives. Now, modern internal auditing focuses on adding value by improving governance, enhancing operational efficiency, and supporting organizational resilience. International experience shows that countries with strong internal audit systems often have more robust financial management frameworks and better mechanisms for detecting and preventing fraud, preventing waste, and preventing abuse. You know, where something is not properly managed, abuse and waste is inevitable. Now, as public expectations for transparency continue to grow, and especially now within our country, because of the many corruption scenarios and cases that have gone on, public transparency, the public is having an outcry for transparency and accountability for public institutions. Now, many governments are investing in strengthening internal audit functions as part of broader governance reforms. And while internal audits alone cannot eliminate the mismanagement of public funds, they remain one of the most effective mechanisms for promoting accountability, improving oversight, and ensuring that public resources are managed responsibly. Now, when supported by strong leadership, effective governance structures, and a commitment to implementing recommendations, internal audits can serve as a powerful line of defense against financial mismanagement and be a catalyst for better public performance sectors. Now, I've come to also realize that the Bank of Namibia really does quite a lot of this awareness and education, yet I don't know what we really do with them. Of course, in regards to media, information is disseminated, but what do people do with this information? Do they really put in the work to ensure that they use the information gained, or perhaps even reach out to the people that perhaps gave the presentations, so as for them to have a know-how how to run their public institutions where they are, you know? Is that something that they really put into work, or is it just research and work and all this? I don't want to say go to waste, because I'm sure there are those people who really make use of it. But if we're really going to talk about transparency, accountability, curbing corruption, we need to take this learnings, this hard work that people put in, even the finances that goes behind it, and really put it into work. Because, you know, I recently came across somebody who is also in the media fraternity. I'm speaking about how they're not in rather they are an analyst, and they spoke about how when government allows certain wrongdoings to continue to happen, they become compliant. Yeah, they become compliant to that. You know, it's almost as you say, when you were with the thief when the thief was taken, so, but you didn't say anything, you never reported, you become accomplishment to that. So it's high time we really put in the work. Let's try and fill those gaps where the gaps are lacking, and really try to combat crime, and try to really make use of what is being put out there for us in order to really help our economy and our country to grow. Because at the end of the day, if leaders don't make use of what is put out there for them, then I really don't know what would then work. But nonetheless, let's still take a listen to I wouldn't want to say, but let's say Deputy Minister of Health and Social Services, Penda Ithindi, who is also. No, now I'm mixing the other one with this one. Pardon me. Let's take a listen to another another auditor was speaking at the Internal Audit Awareness Day at the Bank of Namibia. That'll be news for tomorrow. The one with the Deputy Minister.
I also encourage the audience to reflect on the central theme that underpins today's discussion. Our panel discussion will comprise with questions first directed at our panelists, and then we'll provide an opportunity to...
...are developed by the IPSAS board. ...authorities. ...then our audit. We are...
...have heard you. And we'll reflect on
information from the word go is not reliable. There's a lot of independent assurance that need to be placed on the information for it to be reliable. So you will notice that internal audit is a very big role to play in ensuring that information is reliable. And when information gets to be reliable, then the basis of the decisions that are made is a basis that has a lot of quality, and they are timely, and such decisions are well informed. So regarding the internal audit, ensuring that the reform process is successful, we are saying, from the moment or from the time that we start implementing accrual basis IPSAS, we should ensure that internal audit is capacitated to bring in the independent assurance that will create the information that is integrity, that is grounded in proper sources, that is also derived from verifiable records. So what happens is when we bring internal audit, we are saying the reform process has started. We have also brought in internal audit for the purposes of independent assurance. So we are trying to say, as we walk the talk, we are not decoupling the walk from the talk itself, because internal audit must be embedded in all the architecture of the reform process. And it must, the reform process on its own is an ecosystem. While it is an ecosystem, you will find that there are so many gaps that are going to be created, because we have to move from one point to the other. As we move from one point to the other, there are going to be gaps that are going to be created, because we have to comply with a certain standard of accountability, transparency, and sustainability. So internal audit is a very big role to play there in ensuring that as we move along that process, then information has got integrity and the decisions that are being made are based on reliable information.
Thank you very much for that intervention. So internal audit should be part of the process and ensure the integrity of the process end to end. To conclude our panel discussion, I have two more questions to be directed to the panel. I think to returning to the central theme or the central topic of this discussion, the focus is on impact. So starting with you, Ms. Maxine, what does impact look like for internal audit in the public sector, and how should it be measured beyond compliance?
For me, impact is means changing outcomes. So what I mean by changing outcomes is internal audit creates the impact when it work leads to better decision making, as well as also the strengthening the internal controls as a whole and reduce the risk. And the reason why I'm saying that is that impact in the public sector, that is one of the reasons why we as the directorate develop the manuals for internal audit, because there was no manuals at all. So those manuals actually is a guideline on how to go about the methodology of audit, as well as the competency of internal audit, the quality assurance process of internal audit, and also the audit and a risk handbook, so that that can guide any internal audit function in the public sector, how to go about any of those manuals that we introduce. So that is the impact that we as the directorate made. And that is so important, because now everybody in the government know that it's not about investigations, but it is about following this methodology that is clearly highlighted in the global internal audit standards, and that we also appointing audit committees based on this audit committee handbook, and that also contribute to ensuring that risk identify improve accountability in the organization, and more effective service delivery, as the purpose of the audit committee, purpose of the internal auditors is to by providing the board and management with independent risk-based assurance, advice, insight, as well as foresight. So that is why impact is always, for me, it is about the outcome at the long run. So the purpose of internal audit, how we best minimize the risk from happening. Yes, that is short for me.
Thank you. And the same question to you, Dr. Harold. What does impact look like from an internal audit perspective?
It's a difficult one, but I've spoken about training as part of our mandate. Another mandate is to provide consultancy services. Another one is research. But the one that relates to your question is capacity evaluation. If we train internal auditors, we should be able to go back to where they are and do a follow-up in terms of whether we have really made an impact in terms of the training interventions. That is an area that we have not been doing well because we train, but we don't go back. And I think that is important. If we want to see impact, is when we start treating internal auditors as strategic partners. When I say strategic partners, we involve them in decision-making processes. I know sometimes they don't want to do the job. They will distance themselves that we are not supposed to interfere. But it's important for them to understand systems because they are conducting audits to improve systems. So we should engage them. And impact will only happen if internal auditors have full support from governance and management structures. There is another element which is important, is the awareness. I've just appointed an internal auditor now. I don't think at my institution there was one before. Functions were outsourced. But there is one on board. But staff will not understand the role of that particular person. So staff awareness is important. If you get staff on your side as an internal auditor, I think you will be able to get the desired results. Another issue is culture change. We need to change the way we conduct business. I think the internal auditors are here to assist us to have resilient institutions. Institutions that will continue to exist because CEOs will come and CEOs will go, but if the institution is resilient because of solid systems and structures and procedures, I think you will be able to have a very good institution. That is what we want. So impact is not easy to assess. Even those who are doing their master's degree and PhDs, you want to do impact study, you have to do it over a longer period. So it's not something that we can achieve within a year. But if we are all committed to do that, we'll be able to get the desired results. My own experience.
Okay. Let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
E filosisho o talikula ndula kona avewa yuk. E kwashili palekolo maruendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB. O atupa teleko mesho kwashili palekolo afika mafio pe dola emilio na omlongo danamibia. Moshi yoshe tukeshe kuyanja o makwafo unamiti e nashane filosisho lopa ulumo mumbu. Kwa avoveli ponje yoshilongo, shijoshi topo washo ijo yetu, tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash. Opo umone ya kulolo polis maule o minute dishona elela, lishangifako nhp.com.na o manga ino ya moruendo. Ponje Oshilong, Emangono Malandula Fano, or Dodino Kulandurwa. NHP, rotate in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Lipura nenge no wapungwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewetike kovano ile koshuwa na Unongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito danjuka okukwetera oipindi konu konda doi nawa nuneudo otukwetera o special angeta shake ngejepa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ileko mderewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Okay, and now for news beyond the borders of South and South Africa, very disturbing news. 12 people shot dead in Cleveland, Gauteng. Let's hear more.
Now, Calvin Zuja has been monitoring the situation from a stone throw away from the crime scene itself, and he joins us now live from Jampas Informal Settlement. That's in Cleveland. And Calvin, understand the pathology officials are still combing through that scene, which is very much still active.
Good morning to you, Ayanda, and to our SABC viewers at home. Yes, indeed. A somber moment here at the Jampas Informal Settlement in Cleveland. That is where we are seeing some of the officials, including forensic investigators and pathologists, coming in now to remove those bodies. They are taking those bodies to the mortuary. People are trying now to question police as to what really transpired. Police are saying no, they are going to issue a statement. Now it's sinking in, Ayanda, to most of these residents here on what really transpired yesterday night. Remember, the police provincial commissioner of Gauteng, Lieutenant General Tommy Mthombeni, did mention when he was addressing the media that nine males and three females were shot dead, and we are told that nine are still in hospital. But we have managed, Ayanda and Fundo, to get someone who heard what was happening yesterday. He had gunshots. That is one of the residents here. But for now, we won't be able to show him on camera because we are taking live visuals of those bodies that are being removed by pathologists. Baba, thank you very much for your time. We are live on SABC News. Tell us just how you are doing.
Ngibingelela bonke abahlali bala eSouth Africa. Izolo into eyenzekile 22-9 kuthi kuqala nje ichuma lento leyo kwathiwa ngathi kuma cricket inyana nje sakuthatha kancane sangakulandelile kakhulu kwahamba isikhathi kusukuhamba isikhathi hayi sizoze ukuthi hayi ibhamu lezi sikhalayo lezi hayi zachuma ibhamu sichumile ibhamu 22-9 kwaze kwashaya u-half past 9 siluku sichumile nje sithi uma sizivuka lapho nje uma sisiphuma lapho sathola ukuthi sekunabantu abashonile kodwa ukuvuka kwethu sithole ukuthi kushone abantu abayi-12 masizwa manje ukuthi sekushone abantu abayi-16 hayi siphathanga kahle ngoba asikhonanga ukulala ubusuku bonke sesicashi nje sesingena ngaphansi kombhedi sikhala ubusuku bonke isibhamu sidubule imikhukhu yonke kungakubheki nje ukuthi kudutshulwa abantu kwakudutshulwa nje wonke umuntu
ngokubona kwakho ngoba amaphoyisa athi labantu bafike bavala iy'mbobo iy'ndawo zokuphuma nokungena la iquantum ebelimhlophe is this the first time this incident happens here ngiyaqala ukuzwa ngalokhu how is the situation here the rate of crime and all
hayi indawo yalana bhuti ayikho right lana ayikho safety ayisinto okucala yenzeka please ukwenzeka lokhu ngoba thina vele sisijwayele sisihlizi ngesimo siphoqana isimo kodwa yona into ehlala iyenzeka nje umasipala nje kumele ukuthi ahambele lento ahambele le ndawo asisize kakhulu asikho safety asikho right safety kakhulu
ngike ngeza omunye isakhamuzi saying that there is a local establishment here a tavern around this place abanye bathi kungenzeka ukuthi mhlambe kunomthelela lokho nanokuthi abanye bathi kungenzeka futhi ukuthi lento iyamene nozama laba babizwa ngozamazama ama illegal miners wena njengomuntu ohlala la ngokubona kwakho njengoba amaphoyisa asaphenya ubona ukuthi mhlawumbe ngabe yini imbangela yalokhu icause
ya imbangela lokho icosta yiko vele izamazama ngoba le ndawo lena vele iundermine into eyigcwele lana vele imayini izamazama abantu abahlezi lana vele bahlezi kuzamazama kusebenziwa yona izamazama iyona nje le busy izamazama.
So can you explain to us maybe if people who are around here, the residents, are they working? Where are they working? How is the unemployment rate around this area? Injani ukungaqashwa kwabantu ukungasebenzi kwabantu ngoba abantu abahlala la kule ndawo khona labasebenza khona bavuka ekseni baya benzana emini.
Hayi bambala abantu abasebenza abantu abangasebenzi la the rest abaningi kakhulu wonke umuntu lana abasebenzi basebenza ngayizamazama la the rest people. Abantu abaningi abasebenzi nje bayiphilisa ngayo izamazama yizamazama legcwele lana nje kuphela
yine beningayifisa ukuyibona yenzeka
eish idinga ifiniselana ukuthi yenzeke ukuthi nje umasipala nje ahambele kithi asisize manje mhlambe kube azame ukuthi azame ngeyindlela abone kule ndawo ukuthi angenza kanjani ahambele nje kithi nje abone ukuthi naye kenzela nje siyamdinga nje umasipala nje nogovernment asondele kithi asizane nathi abonisane nathi ukuthi singenza kanjani manje nje ngoba asiphephile sekusift
nasaba manje
manje sisaba kakhulu nje into esiyisaba ke siwazi ukuthi namhlanje siyolala sivuka sinjani yenzeke silale sivuke singazi ukuthi kwenzakala ngoba labantu bathi bayabuya futhi back futhi bazobuya futhi manje asikho safety kakhulu sikho safety nje asiphephile nje asikho mnandi kakhulu asiphephile sicabanga nokuhamba nje semakhaya manje asazi ngoba sihamba semakhaya
sibe bayabuya
bathi bayabuya futhi kuyabuya ikho safety kuyabuya bayabuya ngempela serious bayabuya.
Okay, no baba sibonge kakhulu ngesikhathi sakho sithemba ukuthi mhlawumbe nizosala niphephile. Sibonge kakhulu ngokusinikeza ulwazi. Thank you very much for providing us with those details. They are very important for us and for our viewers at home. Thank you very much for your time.
Siyabonga baphathi nibe kahle noNkulunkulu asigcine.
Thank you very much. Ayanda, this is one of the residents explaining to SABC News, trying to give us a more description and details of what really transpired in here. I don't know, Bulelan, if we can be able to go to the Provincial Commissioner of the South African Police Service, Lieutenant General Chomim Tombeni. I'm far from him, so I could not hear or grasp what he is talking about. But to be safe, we are trying to get a closer. Please bear with us if you happen to see shaky visuals, because we are moving to the Provincial Commissioner of the South African Police Service in Gauteng. He is actually briefing the media about what has happened in here. We will try to get more closer to him so that maybe we can be able to put our microphone so that we can be able to put our microphone and be able to grasp on what the Provincial Commissioner is talking about.
It's still early to can confirm the issues of illegal mining, but of course we cannot overrule that because I've seen some of the victims. There were, I think, one or two, if I'm not mistaken, is two or three, some of the victims where they were lying. It looks like is this a place of the processing center for illegal mining. So one could not overrule that. But as I've indicated earlier, that we're here 3 weeks back through the intelligence-led operation where we got over 1,000, you know, live ammunition of the AK-47. And we also managed to get a three-pistol, three suspect. Added to that, I think we had not less than six illegal immigrants, which we have effected arrest during that time. So we cannot overrule the issue of saying it might be somehow associated to illegal mining.
Quite a handful of investigation now from here. Where to from here in terms of interventions, in terms of people you'll be bringing in special investigators into this this crime scene?
Since yesterday, we have an activation plan which includes the crime intelligence, which includes our tracker team, which includes a crime scene management criminal record center, which includes other government departments. I've just spoken to MEC Mazibuko. MEC Mazibuko, she's responsible for health.
South Africa is also having discussions on high levels or findings about high levels of alcohol use among adolescent girls.
Welcome back. Now, a new University of Cape Town studies revealed alarming levels of alcohol use amongst adolescent girls and young women in South Africa. Researchers found that nearly one in three young women surveyed consumed alcohol, whilst hazardous and binge drinking patterns, they were common, especially amongst those out of school and living in urban areas. Now, experts warn that the findings are deeply concerning, particularly because young women are amongst the most vulnerable groups to HIV infection in the country. Now, given the alarming findings on alcohol consumption, we're going to be in conversation with Dr. Mpho Tladi, a University of Cape Town senior researcher, for more. A very good morning to you, Dr. Tladi, and thank you for your time with us here on the SABC at this hour.
Good morning.
Alarming stats coming through, and perhaps if you unpack the recent study and, you know, just what it notes, one in three young women surveyed consuming alcohol. Did this high prevalence surprise you? Your research team as well, does it align with historical trends? How do we begin to make sense of the facts and figures?
Yes, I think these results are surprising. They are much higher than national surveys that have been done in this particular age group. What's important to note is that the study was conducted in 10 districts that are high HIV risk districts across the country and conducted among 15 to 24 year old young adolescents and young women. And so the findings of very high alcohol use, hazardous drinking and binge drinking are much higher than previously reported.
So, Dr. Tladi, if we're looking at the data highlighting the district rising hazardous and binge drinking, I mean, we're obviously trying to frame it and understand what constitutes to binge drinking. Talk to us about how it's defined, particularly in the context of the specific demographic group and districts that you've outlined.
To define binge drinking, we administered a questionnaire to the young women. It was the WHO Audit C questionnaire,
okay.
And it asked the young women how often they drink more than six drinks in one session. And so this is a recommended definition for binge drinking. So women who drink more than six drinks per session of drinking monthly or less are defined as binge drinkers.
All right. Thank you for setting that context, because even if we look at geographically now, the factors that would have explained perhaps why certain peri-urban districts like Cape Town, Tshwane, have not shown a drastic increase of alcohol use percentage, perhaps compared to some of the others as well. Any inferences that you can draw from that?
Yes. I think what we've found in previous research is that these urban areas, particularly Tshwane and Cape Town, have much higher rates of alcohol consumption than perhaps the more rural areas. What's clear from research is that these are areas where access to alcohol is quite ubiquitous. There's high marketing and advertisements, and these are often targeted at young people. The cost of alcohol in the areas is often reduced, so it's very accessible to young people who don't work. But even furthermore, there's a culture in these urban areas where drinking is part of the social culture, where over weekends, at clubs, at social events are all kind of congregate around alcohol use. And so this happens much more in the urban areas than we find in rural areas, where alcohol use is not as woven into the culture of the rural communities.
Okay, so you're speaking to peer pressure, perhaps even modern forms of advertising. You've got social media, the dynamics that are also feeding this trend. But even beyond that, the economic realities, the hardships as well that are faced in our society. You've got youth unemployment, perhaps a lack of recreational alternatives as well. Is that also contributing factors driving young women towards heavy drinking?
Yes, what we found is that in the study in particular, women who are not in school, so if they're not attending school or are engaged in after-school activities, are those who are more vulnerable to high use of alcohol. So it highlights the importance of keeping young women in school and also providing activities, after-school activities, that protect them from engaging in alcohol use.
But, I mean, because obviously now the ramifications from there into also increase immediate sexual reproductive health risks. This is also linked to the level of consumption, perhaps also some of the unearthings in your findings. Talk to us a little bit more about what was addressed on that front.
For the study was actually a part of a much larger study run by the SAMRC, and it was a study that was trying to assess whether providing certain interventions to young women would help reduce the incidence of HIV. The results from our study are just on the baseline study, so we don't have any follow-up data to report on. But what we understand from engaging with young women is that they are at high risk of acquiring HIV because when they drink, it really limits their ability to negotiate safe sex. It limits their ability to protect themselves from violence. And so drinking has a huge impact on increasing the risk of HIV in this young population.
Perhaps even extended to some of the social ills, the scourge of GBVF as well. The conversations continue as we unpack that report. But thank you for joining us at this hour, Dr. Mpotladi, University of Cape Town, a senior researcher, speaking about the alarming levels of alcohol use amongst adolescent girls and young women in South Africa. Thanks, Doc, for joining us.
Okay, and for some football-related news regarding the FIFA World Cup 2026, exploring the International Football Hall of Fame.
Well, with just one day to go to the FIFA World Cup, Morning Live team, they're out there about finding those hidden gems of Pachuca City. A very good morning to the team. It's over to you. What's happening? We are so excited ahead of that game as well.
Hola, Afrik Dasood. Good morning, Khuyamura San Bonani, everybody. And welcome to Morning Live, coming to you live from Pachuca. And of course, this is where the South African national team, Bafana Bafana, are hosted. And let me tell you, it's one day on your side, two still on our side, but one day back home until South Africa, of course, takes on Mexico in the opening match. And coming to you this morning from the Salon de la Fama, and this is, of course, the International Museum, a Hall of Fame for all of football across the world. And let me tell you, this is a special place. You walk for a few floors as you spiral up to the top, because this is in the form of a sphere, the biggest in the world, a football, and in it, it contains all of the history of world football. Just a sneak peek and you'll see so much more. Looking at some of the greats here, some of the names. And you see there Bobby Charlton, Gerd Müller, Zinedine Zidane, Pele, and Campos, so much more. Franz Beckenbauer. And as you go through this Hall of Fame, these are all of the stories that are told, that are captured. And of course, the memorabilia to go with it. Iker Casillas, Diego Forlan, Ronald Koeman, and so much more. And of course, South Africa also well represented here. For not forgetting, we hosted the 2010 World Cup. It is captured here. And Fun fact, just found out that after the 2010 World Cup, they actually sold a whole lot of Jabulani balls here. So everybody here knows that the football that was used in the 2010 World Cup was Jabulani. And that is because we, of course, had those sold here in great numbers here in Mexico. Well, looking around the Hall of Fame and everything that is captured here, and it's not just about the Football World Cup, but it's also about every other major tournament in the world. And all of that history, all of that memorabilia, all of the stories are captured right here in this museum. And it really is a special, special place. If you have the opportunity to come here, I tell you what, don't miss it. And Africa is also represented here. George Weah, I was looking through some of these plaques here. He's up here, as are so many others as well, as you can see. And it changes all the time. And we are just going to run through Ruud Gullit there. There you have Claudio Suarez. So many of the greats of our time and well before that. And it just takes you down this road of nostalgia, talking about how and what every single cup meant and who were the greats of that time. Here's Abby Wambach as well. So the women's football also well represented here at this particular space. And this is, of course, where the history of football is captured. So Alex Ferguson, so many more. And of course, yeah, some of us in South Africa, I think this was a seminal one for us also, with the first time we watched the World Cup really in 1990, and the likes of Roberto Baggio, where you had that West German team that ultimately were successful. There's Dunga and Luis Flores, so many others, Cafu and Marco van Basten, remember him, the great Netherlands team. AC Milan, yes, that was Marco van Basten, and those days. So I tell you what, it is just a heaven for every football fan to come through here and watch what's been happening there. As you can see, the screens change. That was Gary Lineker. There's Ronald Koeman now. There's Tita now, and so much more. I tell you what, we'll be speaking more about what you can find in here, and more about the South African significance here, because these have a relationship to South Africa, and we'll be speaking to the curators and also one of the guides here to tell us more about the history of world football. And it is all under this magnificent sphere that is the football of world football. And Salon de la Fama del Football International. This is where we are. So stay tuned, Liesl and everybody else. We'll, of course, be bringing you more.
Meanwhile, environmental concerns over Nigeria's $11 billion US coastal highway.
Nigeria's Lagos-Calabar Coastal Highway is being hailed as a major infrastructure project designed to boost transport, tourism, and economic growth. But as construction moves forward, concerns are mounting over its impact on coastal communities, farmland, and fragile ecosystems, including growing risks from rising sea levels linked to climate change.
You know, what side am I?
The new coastal road has destroyed many of our coconut trees and now cuts through the farm. We used to have trees on both sides, especially along the ocean. It was a large farm before. Environmentalists and residents in fishing communities also blame coastal development projects for changing ocean patterns and worsening flooding. Before, the shoreline was far away. Since they started building those new sites, such as the Eco Atlantic project near Eco Hotel, all the sand filling of the ocean they did on the coast has shifted the water levels, leading to ocean surge and property losses. Some environmental advocates say the highway's long-term impact will depend on whether authorities balance development goals with environmental protection.
Now, this road could be a plus or could be a negative. If the attitude of the road is the same attitude that was used during the oil extraction, which caused terrible damage, then it'll be a big negative. But we are hoping and advocating that those who are responsible for making the decisions on the road will realize that, no, we better make this an environment-friendly activity.
Stretching some 700 kilometers when completed, the multi-billion dollar highway is one of President Bola Tinubu's flagship infrastructure projects.
Meanwhile, Reid restricted ease as Trump reclassifies medical marijuana.
The executive order, Donald Trump said this doesn't legalize the drug, pain-relieving miracle, particularly
financial and operational benefits to cannabis businesses like this one. I'll have more on that shortly, but for now, here's Rob Matheson at our Washington studio.
Thanks, John. Now, weed, pot, grass, dope, hash. There are over 1,200 different names for marijuana and its derivatives. To some, it's an almost a pain-relieving miracle, particularly for the elderly and those with chronic illnesses. Others see it as a threshold of a spiral into addiction. The Trump administration is reclassifying medical marijuana. It used to be alongside heroin and LSD, and in future, it's going to be on the same list as over-the-counter pain meds. Now, when he signed the executive order, Donald Trump said this doesn't legalize the drug on a federal level, but it does recognize the medical applications.
For decades, this action has been requested by American patients suffering from extreme pain, incurable diseases, aggressive cancers, seizure disorders, neurological problems, and more, including numerous veterans with service-related injuries and older Americans who live with chronic medical problems that severely degrade their quality of life. I want to emphasize that the order I am about to sign is not the legalization, or it doesn't legalize marijuana in any way, shape, or form, and in no way sanctions its use as a recreational drug.
Well, one thing is certain. Marijuana, cannabis, and all the other derivatives make an awful lot of money. States have brought in a combined $26 billion in tax revenue from marijuana sales. California alone generates more than $1 billion in tax revenue a year. And that money can go to help fund community initiatives like free school breakfasts, substance abuse treatment and recovery programs, construction of new schools, and maintaining state parks. Despite the reclassification, well, there's still a maze of laws at both federal and state level. Rory Challens breaks it down for us.
Wherever you are in Washington, D.C., you're never far away from that unmistakable smell of cannabis. People can buy it from dispensaries like this. It's smoked pretty openly in the streets. In 24 states around the U.S., cannabis is now legal for adult recreational use. In most other states and D.C., there is access to some medicinal cannabis or products with reduced active ingredients. Only two states, Kansas and Idaho, have no legal marijuana program whatsoever. And yet, under federal law, it's still an illicit drug everywhere. So how come I could pop in here, I could buy some weed, I could come out, I could light it up, and I wouldn't get in any trouble? Because for years, US policymakers have told federal prosecutors to deprioritize cannabis enforcement. The Obama-era Cole Memorandum and the Rohrabacher Blumenauer Amendment mean that the US Justice Department largely keeps its nose out of state cannabis laws, particularly medical marijuana programs.
Trump has gone further still, reclassifying medical marijuana and approved products from the Schedule 1 category, which is used for drugs that don't have any accepted medical use, like heroin, to Schedule 3. That's for drugs that do have accepted medical use and lower risks of physical dependence, like ketamine.
The facts compel the federal government to recognize that marijuana can be legitimate in terms of medical applications when carefully administered. In some cases, this may include the use as a substitute for addictive and potentially lethal opioid painkillers. They cause tremendous problems. This reclassification order will make it far easier to conduct marijuana-related medical research, allowing us to study benefits, potential dangers, and future treatments.
So what does the public think?
Well, a strong majority of Americans support the legalization of marijuana for medicinal purposes, and more than half support legalizing it for recreational use too. And that is the direction of travel. Trump is still no fan of recreational legalization, but the Justice Department and the Drug Enforcement Administration are fast-tracking the consideration of rescheduling cannabis completely. Rory Challens, Al Jazeera in Washington, D.C.
Well, we're joined now by Paul Armentano, who's Deputy Director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, known as NORML, and by Jordan Davison, Government Affairs Director at Smart Approaches to Marijuana, also known as SAM. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Paul, I'm going to start with you. Why this and why now, do you think?
Well, this decision has been a long time coming. You know, marijuana was initially classified as a Schedule I controlled substance in 1970, and as early as 1972, Nixon's Blue Ribbon Commission said, that's not right. It doesn't belong there. We should move it. So this is not a new discussion. What happened was, under the prior administration, the Biden administration initiated a reinvestigation of cannabis's status as a Schedule I controlled substance. And as part of that process, the Health and Human Services Department did a review to see if marijuana met the criteria of a Schedule I controlled substance or if it should be classified in some other category. They did a 250-page review. They came back and said, clearly, cannabis has medical utility. They said it doesn't have the abuse potential of other Schedule I controlled substances like heroin or even Schedule II controlled substances like cocaine and methamphetamine. So it should be moved out of Schedule I. That process did not happen. It was not finalized under the Biden administration, but under this administration, the president recently issued an executive order that said specifically state-authorized medicinal marijuana products ought to be Schedule III, and then there will be future hearings before the Drug Enforcement Administration with respect to whether all other marijuana products should also be moved from Schedule I. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, so Jordan...
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkona Nadingi program brought to you by Matthias Hangara. From Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful day ahead. Goodbye.